provided the public 30 days to comment on the applications received. Visit crtc.gc.ca or www.tele1.ca for more information. Reporting for Groundwire, this is Gretchen King.
That's it for this segment.
Welcome to Open Sources Guelph here on CFRU 93.3 FM, CFRU.ca, Guelph Campus and Community Radio. I am Adam A. Donaldson of Guelph Politico, and joining me is...
I thought I was the human beatbox, Scotty Hurwitz. Yeah, I gotta work on that, I guess. Or maybe not.
Do you have to work on it if you're the human beatbox?
The inhuman beatbox. That's my Marvel superpower.
Oh, see
TM
you
TM is a registered
trademark
of I don't know. Stan Lee gonna call me and
this
go.
This is already gone off. This is already dying.
It's already become a totally different show.
All right. Open Sources is CFRU's political and current affairs discussion show, and you can listen to us live here on CFRU every Thursday at 5 p.m. You can also listen to us live online. Go to CFRU.ca and click on the Listen Now icon at the top right-hand corner of your screen, and you can listen to us anytime by downloading the Open Sources podcast on Podbean or through iTunes, Stitcher, and Google Play. Now, today we'll talk about the growing gap in inequality. Stats Can says that poverty is increasing in Ontario but decreasing almost everywhere else in Canada. But why? And we'll probably have some different ideas than what the Financial Post had. And then we will have an interview with Jay Tissick, the leader of the Alliance Party of Ontario. There are a lot of disgruntled Ontario PCs out there, and they have found a voice with the Alliance, including Thomas Mooney here in Guelph. And we will ask them how that might affect the election. And then finally, Steve Paikin has been cleared by an independent review of charges on sexual impropriety. But is this the end of the story, and where does Paikin go from here? That's in the end of the show. But since we're at the beginning of the show, we're going to talk about that election that we just mentioned. And it seems like we're just waiting for it to begin. And, you know, because of that, I think this time next week we'll probably in full-blown election mode. We'll maybe try and have one of the candidates in for next week. That's very much still in the air. But for now, we're just kind of waiting it for all started. And the ball is definitely in Doug's court, because he said some things in February that the Liberals released, and what I think was a pretty successful pre-election attack. Doug Ford saying, I mean, this was probably the biggest news, political news item of the week, hopefully, was that he, Doug Ford at a private meet and greet with some developers said, hey, when I'm elected premier, this Greenbelt thing, history. We're going to just build, you know, because then housing prices will come down, because we're just going to build on the Greenbelt, because that's what's keeping housing prices so high, because we can't build on the Greenbelt. You know, I know that people don't want to compare Doug Ford to Donald Trump, but like talking about business while clearly not understanding how business works, that is like straight up Trump.
Yeah, he's just saying stuff like Trump does, just saying stuff. There's no policy there. Is there a policy document yet for them? I don't think
no.
so.
No.
You will notice with every other party, regardless of what stripe, that most of their talking points, if not all of them these days, unless another topic is brought up, is their policies, and they stick to policies. And it starts to sound, you know, if you listen to enough stuff like we do, it can be a bit repetitive. You kind of look for when they do a little bit of a spin or a bit of a deke or a sort of pandering a bit to the crowd that they're in. But Doug is just saying stuff. And it was like, yeah, the developers had an idea and I agreed with them. And it's, dude, like, and now, like 24 hours later, it was like, nope. Nope, the people have spoken. We're not going to develop the Greenbelt.
Yeah, the people have spoken.
You either are or you aren't. We won't touch the Greenbelt.
Our choose your own policy direction has worked.
Yeah.
We went to page 13 instead of page 56.
You're dead, the end. Yeah.
Yeah, it's...
You blew up.
It's so...
Yeah, it's...
you know, it's...
It really needs to be reined in. Here's a hot tip.
yeah.
conservatives.
I mean, they may see the Trump example, like you don't really have to stand for anything to win, and think, okay, that's how we're going to win, or you know, it's they feel like they don't really have to have, you know, a blue book or something because
we got this.
Yeah, because people
every poll
hate
says we're
going to
win
so much. Yeah. But it's there was a poll. I can't remember who put it out, but I found it on online today. But it said that, you know, about half the electorate, 48% of the electorate, is persuadable, and what they classify as persuadable, like 20% of people, 20% of this 48%. Were people who might be leaning liberal. 11% were potential swing voters, like their vote can change between now and election day. And 16% were like full out undecided. So if you're the 20% that's leaning liberal and you're 16% that's undecided, chances are there's not a lot of Tory votes in there. Because, you know, what's probably going to, I mean, if you're looking for the most obvious quick change, you're probably looking at the PCs. About 24% of the people in this poll were like PC direct. They were like definitely going to be voting PC.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a bit different from the polls. Like who are you supporting right now? It's kind of like what like where are you firmly? So it's interesting that when you can see these bigger polls, like the Main Street one that said 44.9% support for the PCs. That's
yeah, that was the Eric Grenier's poll, wasn't it?
No, that was Main Street.
Oh, I thought it was Poll Tracker, but
no, that was
the number's similar anyway. Was it 40?
It might be similar.
It's all I think it was 44. But they're all within the range.
But the Main Street poll said like he had lost like 5.5% since the last poll, last Main Street poll.
Every time he has an idea,
which says to me like it's maybe it's getting to a point where it's not enough that you're just offering change. Like people have to know what kind of change you're offering. And when you come out and say like all this stuff that's quote unquote just farmland,
we'll find other farmland. We'll find other greenbelt. Yeah, it's Class A farmland.
Yeah,
right. It's like the best there is.
It's like you don't even know. Like,
possibly
where
in the
does
nation.
Food come from? Doug Ford, the waiter. Come on.
No, it comes from Loblaws. Or the restaurant, yes, that's right.
But it's just it's like absurd. It's absurd. Just yeah. You know, like I'm gonna throw this out there. Oh, you don't like it? Well, I'll take it back because that's how it works. Like I don't have an ideology. You tell me what to believe in. Come on.
Not good. Yeah, and for the other parties, the liberals, it seems, are doing that kind of slow and steady, going to remote places and making announcements. I heard there was 450 new guidance teachers proposed to the province. I didn't even realize that guidance teachers were a thing anymore. And interestingly, long-term care beds for Francophone seniors in Hawkesbury. Now, there's a niche market, eh? So they're doing that kind of, you know, bit by bit throughout the province, sticking to the message, here's some money, here's some money. NDP are doing that too, but are tacking more left than they have previously. I think, what was it this week for the NDP was... they're proposing coverage for your take-home cancer drugs.
Cool.
So, yeah, exactly. So they are heading in that pharmacare direction and care for seniors and that kind of left.
And they also had a big kickoff thing.
Oh, massive, yes. Let's see, their biggest ever in Hamilton. So, I don't know. Maybe it was their biggest ever. They keep head counts on these things? I don't know.
It was all over social media. That's all I know. Mm-hmm. Which... You know, it certainly looks good in the pictures, and I don't think the conservatives have anything like that. It's like this should be a big thing for the PCs.
They you have to have the splash.
But I mean, we're going to talk about this later with Jay Tissick. But you know, it's not exactly unity because they've turned off some people. Maybe some of the more enthusiastic people, like a lot of the grassroots people, by what happened. And the Liberals, meanwhile, there was an announcement today that they're ponying up the provincial share for the downtown relief line in Toronto and a couple other projects, like north of Yonge, or north part of Yonge, and then the waterfront LRT. And it's like, wow. It's like They're making this bold step to do the downtown relief line, which they've been begging for yeah. years. It's like Tokyo in August down there some days, and it's just, you know.
Now is the relief line going to be GO under the auspices of GO, or we're not?
No,
sorry,
I think
I don't
it'll
play
be TTC.
The TTC,
yeah.
But I thought they're going to use rail lines, right? Isn't that the idea of it? We'll look into it, folks, and talk about it.
I don't know the exact plan.
Torrey says something like 35 million. Like, he's talking millions of people will take this relief line. So
yeah. Well, yeah.
And he's loving it, too, I guess, because it's an election year for him as well.
Well, it's... maybe
for
Real
the cash,
City
Kathleen.
Will... What was it? No, Transit City. Maybe that'll still become a reality.
Transit
even
City,
though it's,
yeah.
It's,
and then there'll be a Ferris wheel. And,
it's pretty cool. No, that's yeah. the other guy who wanted a Ferris wheel. But no, it's just like this, like just dead pandering, and it's like it's almost sad now. It's like, yeah, these are worthwhile projects to fund, although the downtown relief line probably is not going to be in business till 2031, if that. So it's not like
I can get a seniors pass, I think. Maybe.
Yeah, if we're still around, but. Yeah. The other thing I wanted to point out, especially today because it's Press Freedom Day, or World Press Freedom Day, Doug Ford is like starting his own news network.
What? DNN?
DNN. I like it. But no, he like put out this like campaign commercial that looks like a news piece about, I think it was about bringing down hydro rates.
Oh.
And it looks like a news piece. Like there's a reporter on the scene, and then it cuts to Doug Ford like doing a little presser. And
very creative. Is it fake news, or is it does it say this is a paid political announcement?
Well, it's on Facebook. It's like
it's on Facebook, so they don't have to follow the rules. They can just do whatever, right?
Yeah. So, but I mean, still, it's icky, especially in this like fake news, post fake news environment that political parties are. Or a political party, let's say, is going out and purposely making their own fake news. And, of course, it's being phrased like, well, the mainstream media is going to cover us like they should or whatever.
Who's the reporter? Is it Faith Goldie? Or
no, it's an actor.
Oh, it's an actor.
Because the actor posted it on Twitter like, hey, check me out on this fake TV spot. You know, like
you're
an actor.
Fired.
Like an actor would. Like, it's, hey, I got work. Check it out. Yeah, it's... It's so icky. It's like, I, you know what, if Doug Ford, who's already said he's not going to have a press bus for his campaign, it's just like, you know, your own self-fulfilling prophecy too, because the press isn't going to take it easier on you just because you're trying to avoid them.
Well, except for the Sun.
Okay.
If that hot
right, and there was that memo,
by,
right,
yeah.
from
Is that on Canada Land that we're talking about?
Yes.
Yeah.
That this memo that about like treat the PCs with kid gloves, they're the good guys, and then a lot of the Sun columnists came out and said, oh, that doesn't apply to us, even though most of them don't have to be told to hate Wynn and love Doug. It's pretty much ipso facto. Yeah, so I mean, of course, Corey Tenecki is on Ford's team, so this has him written all over it. The old Harper playbook. Press are bad.
Oh, we've changed everything. No, you haven't.
Bar the press.
It's exactly the same.
I mean, speaking of someone who had to like make a fuss to get into a Corey Tenecki event.
Mm.
Not good.
You gonna try again when he's gonna come to town?
Doug,
probably.
Do you think Doug's gonna come to town?
I don't. I think they might take a pass. We have a reputation here. Or if they do come to town, it'll be some remote outpost in town, like up near Wellington Brewery or something, like way the heck out of the way, right? Where it's like you can see the cornfield yet. So that's where they'll have their event, or Puss Lynch, just on the perimeter, but not quite in town.
Yeah.
Maybe at the Nestle plant. Who knows?
Oh,
I shouldn't say that, actually. The views expressed on this show, in my opinion. And just briefly, I want to mention that Martin Redcone, an article about Mike Schreiner not being
that's
in the debates.
Good one,
very
too.
Good article. So check that out.
But not being in the debates. And
Who better to debate about the Green Belt than Mike Schreiner? Right.
Well, I mean, that was the thing Martin Cohen pointed out, is that in the week where you have like the Green Belt become a campaign issue, and you don't have the Green Party at coming up at a televised debate. And so the first debate is on Monday. It's a city news debate. And there's actually Cynthia Mulligan who posted a picture. She works for City News. She posted a picture of the three campaign people like drawing straws or something about who was going to go first on Monday. And I did a retweet. And it's like, hey, where's the Green representative? Oh, yeah.
Oh, we forgot.
Oh, yeah. They're not invited because they're not cool enough. And they don't like press the flesh enough with the mainstream media. Anyway.
I should mention because we're one of the sponsors that on.
Not us personally, but CFRU.
No, CFRU. When I say we, I'm talking about the collective we, I guess, man.
Stop
CFRU
it.
And others are sponsoring the All Candidates meeting Thursday, May 10th at 7 p.m. at the Italian Canadian Club, 135 Ferguson.
Yep.
Where do the candidates stand on social justice issues? Healthcare, privatization, poverty, education, environment, water. I'm pretty sure we'll both be there. Are you planning to go? Of course you are.
Yeah, I'll
the
be
team,
there.
The whole team.
We'll have action OSG
team will
coverage.
Be there.
We'll have the live spot. We'll have two cameras there.
If you can't make it, but of course, and it's on show night as well, but that's fine. At least they waited an hour. It's not
Yeah,
like,
well, that's true. Beginning of an hour.
Normally,
down
so many political things happen when we're here, but.
Yeah, that's true.
Including this show. Ha! Anyway.
I do want to quickly, before we move on to the next topic, because I did mention International Press Freedom Day. It's the 25th annual International Press Freedom Day declared by the UN. The 2018 theme is Keeping Power in Check, Media Justice, and the Rule of Law. So it's, you know, this is kind of somewhat directed at what's going on south of the border, you know, with people misunderstanding the role of the media, and especially what happened at the White House press correspondents dinner last weekend, where the White House press corps decided they should blame the comedian who pointed out that the press secretary lies rather than blaming the press secretary, which I thought was quite disgusting.
Free speech.
Yeah, Andrea Mitchell and Maggie Haberman and everybody who, you know, tried to make Michelle Wolf ashamed of being an excellent comedian should be ashamed of themselves. Especially since I was watching Reliable Sources the next day, and some of the people there were talking about how it felt like old times, like hanging out with the administration. And what they were really doing was mourning the loss, the potential loss that they were going to get their precious access to journalism back, which is really the point of it. Mm-hmm. So I want to talk about what's real. In 2017, 48 journalists were killed worldwide. And there were, and this is a particularly big story this week because there were 10 journalists killed in Afghanistan in a single day alone, mm-hmm. 9 in a bombing in Kabul. So on top of that, 662 journalists have been imprisoned worldwide. Again, this, none of this isn't kind of in our backyard, but, you know, in places around the world, it is dangerous to be a reporter. And, you know, as we're kind of seeing, it doesn't take too much to start tipping things the other way. So if you want to learn more about this, you can go to the website for the Committee to, excuse me, the Committee to Protect Journalists. And they actually have interactive maps and stuff so you can see where journalists are endangered. And it's really quite fascinating. And you should check it
for
out.
For sure.
Shout out to the World or International Press Freedom Day. Okay. Speaking of things that don't get enough coverage, poverty in Ontario, according to Stats Can, poverty is actually going down in most places across Canada, except for Ontario and Prince Edward Island. This sort of came to the fore because Matthew Lau, a columnist with the Financial Post, did a piece on it, and he basically put the blame on, you know, Ontario's high hydro rates and the increase in the minimum wage, both of which can be traced immediately back to the present Liberal government. I don't think anyone would disagree that high hydro rates play a role, but I mean, the Stats Can doesn't have statistics for the impact of the minimum wage increase yet, since it was 4 months ago. So I think that's a bit of a stretch. But it was so weird because the timing of this, because we had I can't remember what it's called. The point in time report. That's right. The point in time report for Guelph Wellington. In terms of it's kind of like a census they do of homelessness in Guelph and Wellington County. And right now, 325 people are homeless in Guelph and Wellington County. 93 of them are young people under the age of 24. About half of them are couch surfing, so they're not technically living on the street, but they do have a deficit of I guess, housing. Mm-hmm. You know, it's not unstressful when you're couch surfing because you have no permanent residence. And you know what? I see a lot of signs around town that say now hiring. And so I don't think it's in a minimum wage, Matthew. I don't think so.
No, and that was the problem with this piece. I mean, the headline is a little bit misleading because I think it was actually a bit of a liberal hit piece. So it was, yeah. Is he on the Financial Post? Was he a freelance person? He was quoting
no,
Fraser.
No, I've seen him in the Financial Post before.
He was quoting Fraser Institute. He was quoting people that work for the Fraser Institute. Like, what's his name? What's his name? Should I put my name straight? From campus.
Ross McKittrick.
Ross McKittrick, who was a Fraser Institute fellow, I suppose you'd call him, but he's also a professor here.
Yeah.
So everything that he was referencing was like, okay, this
also
is...
Also famous climate change denier.
Yes. And this was all right-wing think tank stuff rather than... You know, the stats that you were giving make sense to me. It's like you've got some hard numbers there. It's this many people in town and this much, et cetera. Whereas this was more like the liberals stink.
Yeah.
But it starts off, is poverty a problem? Of course it's a problem. It always has been a problem to varying degrees. But this piece doesn't really accomplish anything in telling you how it's going to be alleviated under whoever. Is it going to be, you know, hold on to your hats if it's the Ford Nation. Because I think, considering how many of them are aligned with the, including Mike Harris Jr., presumably, the Harris years were, it went from under the NDP, the poverty gap was as closed as it was ever going to be in the 90s. Mm-hmm. And then the hatchet came in 95, and it's never, ever recovered from that. And it'll be like, they lean towards basic income. They'll say, I think Ford's even said it in campaigning as far as like, basic income. Right, basic income.
Yeah, they're going to keep the pilot project going.
The pilot project going and then maybe expand it. There's always this talk of like, but they like basic income because that means it takes away from all those other programs. It's like, well, you've got an income now. We don't have to give you glasses. Well, you've got an income now. We don't have to give you dentures. We don't have to give this. It's the ultimate kind of free market approach to that and proven that it doesn't solve all the problems. It's one of those things that sounds, one of those ideas that sounds good on paper, but...
Yeah.
Is it working? Well, we don't have it yet, so we don't know. There's the pilot project, like you say, but it's a chronic problem.
Well, yeah, and it doesn't take into account what I think is one of the prime motivating factors for homelessness, which is that the you're talking about an area, the GTA area, the greater GTA area, I guess what they call the GTHA, the Greater Toronto Hamilton area now.
It's getting bigger.
Yeah.
Horseshoe meets the GTA.
But you're talking about, 10 million people out of like 30 million people across the country, 10 million people living in this like one stretch from Windsor to Kingston.
Mm-hmm.
And what do all these places have in common? It's like the housing prices keep going up. It's this epicenter in Toronto and it goes out because the more prices go up in the middle, the more people start moving out into the further circles. Mm. And, you're talking about affecting millions of people. And that's one of the reasons why homelessness is such a problem here, is that we've got a low stock. There isn't a lot of rental opportunities available, especially like primary rentals, like one-bedroom apartments. There's no one-bedroom apartments.
No.
So... you're stuck.
Yeah.
You're stuck with what there is, and what there is price within the market. And this is where we get into like the stuff about affordable housing. What happened at City Council a couple of weeks ago, where Mayor Guthrie says, voting against the 75 Dublin project is a vote against affordable housing. It's like, well, technically, I suppose you're right, but the city of Guelph's definition of affordable housing is affordable in relation to the market, not affordable in, hey, you working a minimum wage job 40 hours a week, you can't get an apartment, here's an apartment for you.
No, it's affordable to somebody who's selling up from Toronto or from their house and downsizing. Yeah. That's who it's affordable for.
Yeah, yeah.
And when we're talking poverty, like pure poverty, I mean... those so-called affordable houses are a completely different world from the stats that you're talking about, the 350 people or whatever. There was no...
325
with no... Well, 325 that we know of, right? Those are the ones that are documented.
Right, I mean, that's the shadow on all of this, is like you're going to get people... I mean, this was done by the Guelph Wellington Task Force for the Elimination of Poverty.
We're right
so
in there.
People
yeah.
who are familiar to people. Yeah. But even then, it's hard to get people to come out and talk about openly with, you know, people who look like they're in authority about their homelessness because there's shame, because there's distrust and other things. But yeah, it's, you know, when you're talking about emergency services too, one of the things that the report revealed, like 88% of these people have no access to emergency shelters. And you think, like,
there aren't any.
There aren't any. There's like five shelters with a total of like 90 beds.
And isn't one of them with like open with two beds, and that's so you can come down from crystal meth or something? Two beds. I mean, come on.
And that's at Wyndham House. That's at like a pilot.
Which
at
is great. Take the two beds, right?
Great. But, you know, one of the things that I don't think people get is, you know, you do your 28 days in the shelter. And then you're out, and you either find someplace to live, or they help you find someplace to live, or, you know, you're in the park or couch surfing or whatever until I think 3 or 4 months is up, and then you can go back in.
And I've heard in Guelph that it's a real hassle to get in the shelter. It's very not just restricted, but in terms of the timeline, I mean, like, you got to show up at this time, and then you go over here. And if you're on any substance at all, you can't get in. And it's like there's these massive restrictions on it.
And that's the other thing, too. I wrote stuff down.
Don't we all, yes.
But, yeah, it's...
The stats are stats, right?
But yeah, like, there's six... Like, I think it was something like six... Okay, here we are. Yeah. 75% have an addiction issue.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's something like 60 have, like, a mental health issue.
And lots of overlap.
Right, and there's lots of overlap. Yep. So it's tricky to get an apartment that way, tricky to stay in a shelter. But the things that are keeping you homeless, I mean, the fact that the minimum wage is so high, does it matter to you?
Not
when
at
you
all.
Can't
again,
keep
it's a different
job
world.
Or you can't get a job because of your addiction or because of your mental health issues. So.
Yeah, I mean, there's only two ways you're going to increase somebody's income that can afford things, right? It's either you gainfully employed or you give them the money, right?
Mm-hmm.
But then when you do that, the tone becomes, oh, it's you welfare bums, right?
Yeah.
And cuts.
Yeah.
It's just, you know, it's a lose-lose, to use that old chestnut. But it's like, you can't please. When it comes to poverty, it's like, poverty has always been with us. Yes. What are we going to do? Well, we're going to try this. We might try this. I found it, like, just on the surface.
Yeah.
You know, when you hear about this, is the, what's the van called again? The Saugeen van. There seem to be more services creeping into town. The van that comes and helps.
Oh, the community
addition, which
health
I think
van,
is absolutely fantastic.
Yeah. Yeah.
So there have been some initiatives. They all seem to be independent. I'm sure they're probably getting some public money somehow. They're not completely funded by, say, the municipality or the city or whoever.
Yeah.
Or the province. But we definitely need more of that. I think the van comes once a week.
It's a Thursday, yeah.
Yeah, it's like, it's got to be more.
And they already have a clientele and everything. And it's not all bad news for Ontario because the province releases its own report, and while it shows that there is some reduction, and like almost 38% of people kids who are in like what they call deep poverty have been lifted, I guess, into regular poverty. So, I mean, there is progress. It's slow progress, and it's the progress isn't reaching all areas equally. Like some groups, like traditionally marginalized groups, like Indigenous people, single parent homes, and people with disabilities, it doesn't reach everyone equally. But, you know, it's the progress is very slow. But this like Financial Post piece did not address any of the real causes. I didn't think
so at all. No. It's one of those. The headline is almost deceptive as to what the content is. As soon as I start reading, it's like, oh yeah, and then the green energy is blah, blah. You're not even talking about poverty when you're talking about windmills, right?
Nobody without a house.
You're tilting at windmills. You're not talking about
smooth. Let's take a break.
Yeah, I think we should take a break.
It's steamy in here.
Yes.
Anyway, we're gonna get our guest on the phone, and then we will talk to Jay Tesic about the Ontario Alliance Party, and then we will get into TVO stuff, and you know what we mean by that. You're listening to Open Source as Guelph here on CFRU 93.3 FM, CFRU.ca, Guelph Campus, and Community Radio. I didn't like guns, and I love them.
That was Tanis Sliman from her album Lucky Blue. And Lucky Tanis is retiring from the University of Guelph after 36 years today. Congratulations to Tanis, and you'll see her around town and on the festival circuit and wherever fine folk music is being played. So well, congratulations, Tanis.
That was her retirement plan.
Yeah, she's not even listening because she's at the Bullring right now. So there you go. How's that for local? Yeah.
That was pretty local.
There you go.
Joining us from afar, though, is Jay Tissick. He is the leader of the Alliance Party of Ontario, and he is running in Ottawa-Carleton, trying to create a bit of an upset there, and he's joining us now by the phone. Jay, how are you?
Doing well, thanks. How are you?
I am doing all right. Thanks so much for calling us from away up in Ottawa. I guess, first of all, tell us a bit about yourself for people who aren't familiar with you, and tell us a bit about the Alliance Party of Ontario.
Sure. Well, I think most importantly, I'm a married father of three children, and I've been in politics for a long time, kind of behind the scenes, and I noticed things just getting worse and worse, you know, and despite our best efforts, and I was really worried about my children's future, and that's what drove me to kind of step into the forefront and kind of run, as it were. I'd always enjoyed being behind the scenes, but we had in Carleton a candidate that I just thought had a very questionable past, who I didn't think would represent this riding very well. So I'd stepped in to challenge the nomination. And what ended up happening was, this was under Patrick Brown, and I think everyone's quite familiar with the rigged nominations and the cheating that went on. So that had happened to me, and I had gone very public and exposed it, and it turned out a lot of people reached out to me saying the same thing has happened to them, and eventually we just realized that we needed to form a new party if we're going to bring integrity back to this province. So,
So I take it you feel the same way about the Ford's appointing candidates, and I guess, was it 11 ridings? I think so.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
So you...
I guess the idea is, and I think Scotty was getting at, is that, you know, there was this walkout of people like you who, you know, have conservative ideas. We're looking forward to having a good race I think a likely electoral victory over the Liberals. But, you know, your principles are what they are. And even though Patrick Brown is gone, that's still carrying on. You still have a leader who's imposing his own will on the party and over local members and who they choose to run for office.
Well, there's a lot there that I'd like to speak to.
Sure.
First off, to say conservative, I don't know that democracy is necessarily a fully conservative value. I think we all agree that democracy is better, you know, and we all appreciate our ability to have input over our government. So when it's being undermined, I don't think that's a conservative issue or a liberal issue or even an NDP issue. That's just a freedom issue. And so that I took a real offense to the undermining of democracy that was done with Patrick Brown, and as you point out, has been continued by the party even after Doug became leader. I don't know if it was Doug personally, but who's to say. It's just 75 appointments to date in that party is pretty frightening. And the reason why, if I may, is just that in our system, I mean, we have a two-party system, right, for the most part. And so by the time you get to election, it's either going to be whoever's the conservative or whoever's the liberal in your riding, and sometimes the NDP when people are really upset, hopefully upset enough to vote Alliance this time. So the real democracy, where people really get to choose their representatives and really the only legitimate on-road to democracy, is at that nomination. That's where you have a say. And when that's undermined, when that's taken away, then there really is no democracy left. And I say that because even communist countries have elections. They just determine the outcome by telling you who you're allowed to vote for. And this is no different. So to me, that's why it's so serious. And it's not about left, right, or any of those dichotomies. It's really about what kind of society do we fundamentally want to have? Is it one where elites are making decisions behind, you know, closed doors, or is it one where the people are really determining their own way forward? So it's you know, the back rooms versus the town halls, and I really want to see a society where decisions are made in the town halls.
So I guess along those lines, we were kind of having a look at your platform before the show, and one of the main points that you make on your website was that the Alliance will fight against government overreach, intervention, and intrusion. That's a direct quote. Do you, what in your view would be the area where you see the most kind of intrusion by the government? I know there's probably lots, but what would be the, you know, your number one, I guess, in terms of government interference in
mine
people's
or
lives?
What I think is,
well, your own or the parties, doesn't matter. Yeah, I'm sure you have your own personal view, but yeah.
Yeah. Well, again, you pointed out it's hard to say which one would be the worst. You know, there's so many on every level of our lives, and that's really the concern. I mean, it's getting to the point where you can't even tie your shoes without a government bureaucrat giving you, you know, a memo on how it's expected to be done and a fine if you do it wrong. So I think at the education system is a really stark example of government overreach. I mean, parents were denied any choices in that. And generally, in society, we are. And if I may just give you an analogy, like, I think the school system's broke. I think that I believe most in our party do, that the Ministry of Education is a bloated and failed bureaucracy. And it's trying to impose one kind of system with a guaranteed equality of outcome across an entire province where people are very different. You know, and that was never the design of our education system. It was meant to be handled very locally with a lot of parental involvement. And I kind of like to look at it as if we step back and don't think of it as public education, which is something that we all appreciate, that we have this. It's a nice thing to have this public education where everyone is getting a good standard of education, or was. But when you remove the bad aspect from it and look at it very objectively, you start to realize what's wrong with it. And I like to use the example of a grocery store. You know, if the government were to decide one day that food distribution was far too important to leave to free markets, that they had to intervene and guarantee, you know, an equality of distribution, what would happen is you'd be assigned a grocery store based on your postal code. You were only allowed to go to that grocery store. You couldn't choose to go to another one. And when you go into the grocery store, you don't shop. There's not aisles with product lining the walls and you pick and choose. You're just handed a bag. And that bag has been pre-made for you, determined, you know, based on what they believe the caloric value or needs of your family are. And you walk out with that bag. And when you get home, you find out much of the stuff in there you don't want, you don't like, whatever, but you can't do anything about it. So you wonder, how do things get into that bag? Well, it's lobbyists at the minister's office, you know, pushing to get their products in the bag. That's literally how our school system is run. And I don't think any of us would accept that in a grocery store. So why would we accept it in something so important as the education of our children? To me, that's one of the biggest ones. You know, I look at the education system as a meat grinder where they're just throwing every student in one end and expecting them all to be homogenous on the other side. And it just doesn't work because people aren't the same.
So what would you say would be the fix for that, in terms of like a one centralized system or something decentralized? Or
Well, decentralized, I believe, is always better. But
so like by the county, like sort of the, like, to go back far enough, like a one room schoolhouse model where it is super local education.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, that's going back to way far.
Sure. No, but I mean, our system's based on that initially, right? Like,
yeah,
right. It's way out of control. Everyone agrees beyond that now, but.
Oh yeah. Well, yeah. No, actually something similar to that, the original Education Act was written to reflect that, but you know, it was local boards determining for themselves. They would do their own hiring, set their own curriculum, and it would be with parental involvement.
Right.
You know, and that's what it was intended to be. It's been changed over time, and now the ministry just determines for all schools across the province. But yeah, what I'd like to see is a free market approach. There's lots of good examples. I don't know exactly what we'd advocate for. I mean, that's got to be a decision that comes from the people and through a lot of consultation and some expert reports. But we do see working examples. We see New Zealand runs entirely on a charter school system where basically, you know, anyone can open up a school and parents can go where they choose, and the government gives a voucher, which is the value of, you know, the child's education to the parents, and that money follows the child. And if they want to take their kid to a different school, they can walk out and the money follows them, you know. And so it really breeds competition, so schools get better, they try harder, and I think private business runs much more efficiently, partially based on need, but then the government does. So these schools would be run highly efficiently and with parents in mind.
And
students.
Most importantly, the students. I I've talked to Thomas about this, who's the running for your party here in Guelph, yeah. and about the idea of decentralization and you know more local, more decisions locally driven. And I asked him this, and I wanted to get your feeling too. That you know, in the end, I think a lot of people agree that we, you know, the problems of Guelph are different from the problems in Ottawa, different from the problems in Toronto and North Bay, et cetera. But at the same time, we are talking about a provincial government level, which means we do all have to come around that same big table. So how do you rectify the, you know, your desire for local-based solutions with, you know, the office you're running for, which is to sit around that big table and decide how to direct things from a provincial level?
Okay, so for starters, I actually don't like the party system.
Mm-hmm.
I really think it's a bad way to go. I think, you know, it means that the people who are supposed to be representing you, who you elect to represent you, they have a split obligation because they also have to represent the party.
Right.
You know, so their loyalties are split in a sense. And I would like to see a situation where it's treated more like a city council, where everyone's elected, you just run, you get elected because the people want you to represent them. And that's the only group that you're beholden to is the people who voted for you, and then everybody just goes to this big table and sits around and debates issues until they come up with a majority, you know? And I think there'd be a lot more trying to cooperate with others if that were the case, because to move forward, you would need everyone on your side, whereas now, once you get a majority government, you do what you want, and you don't care what anyone thinks, right? Which mm-hmm. is unfortunate. So that said, what we've tried to do, because I don't think we're ever going to see an end to the party system, unfortunately, but so we got to work within the system we have. But our party's set up quite different. I mean, obviously, we don't whip any votes. We want people to be free. And when you started asking me actually about Thomas and the question, I was going to say, well, speaking, you know, Thomas is better equipped to speak to Guelph than I am.
I
trust his opinion. So what we do, though, the way we set up our party is policies are driven regionally and then brought up to the party from the grassroots and then addressed through a Senate, which is a regional Senate. You know, so we don't make policy centrally from a leader's office or from, you know, a party executive standpoint. That those policies really come up from the grassroots, get fed to us, and then we try and address the issues. And, you know, that, and then there's a Senate, too, like I said, within the party that reviews the policy to make sure that it is addressing the needs of the ridings that put it forward. So we're looking at it very differently than what you've seen in normal political parties.
Well, let me ask you this then. You know, you're obviously looking to upset, and you know, not just the election but the system itself. So, are you realistic in your goals? I mean, what would be a success for your party coming out of this election?
I'm going to step back to what you said that we're looking to upset, and I think that's not quite correct. I think we're looking to restore. I think the system's already been upset.
Mm-hmm.
Like, it's been very badly corrupted, and we're looking to restore it, which is a very different thing than looking to upset. But a win for our party, to answer that question specifically, we're realistic. I mean, we've got some great candidates in a number of ridings, and I think that they're going to do really well. I hope to see them win their seats. I think we will pick up some seats. Obviously, making government now is quite ambitious.
Mm-hmm.
With only a month left. We're a young party. I mean, we've been working at this for a while, but we only got it registered in November of last year. So we're really talking about a few months to put this together with all, you know, the growing pains that any organization would go through, you know. So I think realistically, we're going to pick up a few seats. And I think in other ridings, we're going to surpass that. There's a 2% threshold that opens up funding. I think we're going to beat that 2% threshold, and I think we're going to be looking at a number of seats, which is an interesting prospect considering, I know the polls are really pointing towards one outcome in this election.
Sure.
I don't think, you know, they did the same thing with Hillary Clinton in the States, though, so how much can we rely on polling? I think we're looking at a minority government. There's a lot of dissatisfaction in the people, which means that nobody's going to be given a full mandate because they don't really trust any of the parties, you know.
Right.
Dissatisfaction moves people, but trust tells you where they move. And I don't see anyone who's managed to build that trust in the voters to the point that they're going to get a majority. I think we're looking at PC or even probably an NDP minority, in which case, though, a handful of seats is a really powerful position. I think we can do a lot to advocate for our constituents from that position, and that's what we're really hoping to do.
All right. Well, we wish you luck, and you know, if you're down in Guelph, maybe we could continue the conversation face to face. Otherwise, Jay Tissick, thank you so much for talking to us today.
Thank you.
All right. And that was Jay Tissick. He is the leader of the Ontario, or the Alliance Party of Ontario. Realistic but optimistic. That was fun.
He's got some enthusiasm there, which is, yeah. Aim high. Aim high, right?
Aim high.
Aim to win.
Absolutely. speaking of enthusiasm, or maybe not enthusiasm. I don't know where I was going with that. So Rachel Turnpenny, who was an independent investigator looking into allegations that Steve Paikin offered former Toronto mayoral candidate Sarah Thompson an indecent proposal back in 2010, came back. She found no evidence that Steve Paikin violated any of TVO's rules. She also, worth pointing out, found no evidence that Sarah Thompson was lying. So, I mean, it's kind of a bizarre situation because Christine Blatchford talked a lot about how Stephen Paikin is the loser in all this. Well, he's not really a loser. He still has his job. He's always had his job.
Yep.
There was never
$300,000 a year job.
Yeah, and there was never
a bad gig.
I don't think there was ever a shadow of a doubt over him either.
Yeah.
I think it may have muddied him up a little, but I mean, his reputation was so squeaky clean to begin with. It was.
Yeah, this is one of those things. I mean, absolutely everybody and across the board, left, right, whatever, is saying that this guy is a stand-up guy, and there's no way. And of course, people who defend themselves of Me Too. It was weird. One of the headlines was like he's been accused of, I can't remember how they phrased it, but it was weird. It's like there's been some Me Too accusations. Like it's not a legal thing. It was like the way it was written was it was trying to be a crime headline when actual fact was like, well, there's been some allegations which have been thoroughly investigated by the sounds of it, which was of course the right step for them to take. But yeah, from what everybody said, Paikin is like, there was no way that it could be him. But then again, it's like, well, what was one of the quotes was like, he is incapable of behaving badly. But the thing is, I guess we're all capable of behaving badly. The problem in this case is that it sounds like it's complete. I think he described it as spurious, which is true, or has turned out to be true. That it's unfortunate that something like as serious as Me Too has been taken to this level where somebody wanting to do a hit job on somebody that they seem to have a problem with. What was it to do with Thompson being on the agenda?
Yeah,
and she was insisting that, after this happened, I was never on the agenda again, and she was.
And she was.
It just seems like everything.
But she did actually address this. She put a thing on Women's Post,
which is her blog, right? Women's Post is her.
It's her. Yeah, it's her magazine. She's the publisher.
Because I read it, I noticed she spelled Steve Paikin wrong at least once. Did you see that too? Or?
I just wanted to say that I have written for Women's Post.
Really?
I did book reviews a couple times for Women's Post.
Wow,
so this was back in.
Good for you.
This was 10 years ago, and I never met Sarah Thompson.
I got the impression that it was like a one person show.
No, it's not a one person show.
Oh, okay.
I wanted to stand corrected. Yeah. What's fascinating.
That's fantastic you wrote for Women's Post. I'm going to look it up.
Oh, who knows? Actually, I think I have my clippings from
What
there.
Was the book? 50 Shades. No, I don't know.
Really?
No, you reviewed the movie.
Really?
This
was before 50 Shades, to be fair. Yes, I did review the movie on end credits from a couple of weeks ago. Find that in the podcast channel. The thing that she did, she had a witness too, which made this kind of provocative, that she had her assistant there who she did not name. That Women's Post piece too, she also said that she wanted to take care of this like in private. And then TVO went and made it public, which was probably the right thing to do because you don't want to be found out to be covering up, you know, an investigation into your star. So,
a provincial organization.
That may have been a bit unlikely for her to think to begin with that was going to be handled all internally with TVO, with, you know, nothing happening in public. But she posted screen grabs of an email and then of a Facebook thread between her and her assistant. Her assistant was unnamed, and then the screen grabs, which was a Facebook conversation, he was named. From what I understand, he did not back up her her version of events in that in the middle of lunch, Steve Paikin just leans over and says, oh, by the way, I'll have you on the show more if you sleep with me.
With a bunch of people there.
Well, the witness was the assistant. The assistant was sitting there too. And apparently the witness was found uncredible, or he did not, or he took back the what he said in the initial email. So the situation is still muddy, unfortunately, because, you know, the thing about Me Too was that we want to believe women first.
We have to.
Yes.
But then there are times such as this.
Well, there are times such as this. And again, I come back to the fact that no one said that she was lying or that she made it up. It's just that there was no evidence found to substantiate her claim because her eyewitness kind of flaked out. So that's the tricky part in all this. And I don't want to come out and say, like, oh, she made it up. But one of the things I will say is that one of the things we've seen in the Me Too era, somebody's accused, and we definitely saw this with the aforementioned Patrick Brown, somebody's accused, and then the whisper gallery kind of steps up and says, oh yeah, we were talking about this for years. It happened with Brown, it happened with Weinstein, it happened with Spacey, I think it happened with Louis C.K., John Lasseter. It's happened with a bunch of people who, you know, as soon as the court comes off, people start freely talking about this open secret that they all knew. But none of that happened with Steve Paikin.
No, there were
subsequent accusers.
That's the progression is, this happened. Me too, me too, me too, me too.
Right.
It was like, this happened. Yeah. Everybody went.
Well, that's the root of it.
And everyone went, no way.
Yeah.
Except one person, so.
Mm-hmm.
And Sarah Thompson is one of those figures that just kind of comes and goes. She ran for mayor of Toronto, didn't she?
Yeah.
And what was the person that did the evaluation said she was a complex complainant. I would love to know more fly on the wall behind the scenes in terms of like, okay, like how complex can it be?
Right. Well, I think it's because of her, you know, history, right? She was kind of seen as kind of a fringe, even though she was one of the leading mayoral candidates. Yeah. She was kind of a fringe.
But think back, though, I don't think anybody disbelieved her when she said Rob Ford slapped her on the bum.
No, that was kind of the thing that kicked off the dissembling of Rob Ford, right? Because that was at that that armed forces dinner where he showed up drunk, and I think that was the big Robin Doolittle first report, and then a couple of months later,
the wheels came off all crack all the time.
Mm-hmm. People definitely believed her then, and
it's possible that happened.
I think there were, if not witnesses, but people overheard her talking about it.
Yeah. But then there's this.
Of course, Rob Ford the late Rob Ford has a laundry list of other things, including saying on live TV that he had plenty to eat at home.
Oh, yeah.
Remember that, everyone? Good times.
Oh, boy.
I mean, so now his brother's running for premier, which brings us full circle.
Yeah, the Ford Nation rises again, maybe. We'll see.
Not if Jay Tesic has anything to say about it. Anyway.
We'll have extensive coverage on all of this.
Yeah, I mean, that's...
for the next month.
Yep, we're likely next Wednesday, or this coming Wednesday, I should say, is when we'll likely drop, and we'll have blow-by-blow coverage as it all goes down. And as I said at the beginning of the show, we're going to try and start getting candidates in as soon as next week, if at all humanly possible. And we've already begun talking about our election night show offline. So we'll have more details for you then.
We're getting ready.
Stay connected to our website, opensourcesguelph.com, Open Sources Newswire on Facebook, @OS_Guelph on Twitter, and you can hear past episodes of Open Sources on the Guelph Politicast channel on Podbean or through iTunes, Stitcher, and Google Play. You can find me on Twitter @AdamADonaldson or go to guelphpolitico.blogspot.ca.
Scotty Hertz on Facebook, Scotty Hertz on Twitter, and I blog at spannerbook.wordpress.com.
Mm-hmm.
I try anyway.
And you can try and hear DJ Sounds Good to Me here at the top of the hour on CFRU 93.3 FM, CFRU.ca, Guelph Campus, and Community Radio. We will be back here next Thursday, of course, Thursday at 5 p.m. for more Open Sources. We will see you then.